Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. This is WGTD-FM. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW-Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Jess Sheeler, an outreach and career transition specialist at Job Corps, Steve Brown, assistant professor of education leadership at UW-Oshkosh, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Manji. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
And a very pleasant good morning and welcome to this edition of Education Matters here on WGTD-HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. I'm your host this morning, Steve Brown, and we have two segments this morning. Our first segment is with Heather Dubois-Bornain, and she is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Public Education Network. And in segment two, I'll be speaking with Dr. David Bob, and he is Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Institute located in Arlington, Virginia. And I'm very pleased to welcome into this segment of Education Matters my guest, Heather Dubois-Bornain, and she is the Executive Director of the Wisconsin Public Education Network. Heather, welcome to Education Matters.
Thanks, Steve. It's great to talk to you.
I recall reading an article, actually an opinion piece that you wrote back in September of 2012. The headline was, Governor Walker's Education Plan is Catastrophic for Both Students and Teachers. I remember reading this and having my students, I teach school law, educational leadership. I'm currently on faculty at the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. In this opinion, this op-ed that you wrote, you said, quote, as a parent who strongly believes in the need to invest equally in all of our students, I am terrified by the dangerous pattern you, and you're referring to the then governor, have clearly established here and have publicly promised to see through to the end. And you're talking about school choice. You're talking about, and I'm just wondering, when you wrote that, what was the impetus that made you actually write that, other than your strong feelings about what was going on at that time?
First of all, I'll clarify one thing.
Sure.
That piece and others that I've written were a response not just to former Governor Walker's, stated vocal and monetary support of school privatization,
mm-hmm.
but what was the simultaneous defunding and undermining and creating barriers to success for kids in public education. And so it's not like a one or the other kind of thing. You know, sometimes I think pro-public education folks are framed as just being against school choice or against private schools. Nothing could be further from the truth for me personally, right? I don't have any problem with private school education, but I do have a problem with the governor's 2011-2013 biennial budget, which didn't just go after, you know, teachers' benefits or collective bargaining, but took the deepest, biggest cut to public education that we've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a cut from which our schools are still reeling and have not recovered. Our current funding rates, when adjusted for inflation, remain below the level they were in 2009. And so there was a fiscal crisis in our public schools at this time that was just exacerbated by the governor's comments at that time about how he wanted to further expand the private school voucher program, pour additional public funds into these programs, siphon them directly through the public schools' budgets to kind of play this shell game so there's never full accountability or transparency for where those dollars are going. And at this time, you know, 2012, I didn't have the job I had now.
Mm-hmm.
I was just kind of a mad mom trying to respond to all of this and make sense and let lawmakers know that, you know, the public is really not okay with this line of investments. And And I just couldn't help myself from speaking out. And I'm very glad that I did, because what I found was that I was not alone in having these concerns. And there was already an established and growing movement of others who shared both my passion and my deep concerns for the future of our public schools. And it was, you know, through sharing my opinion in articles like that, that I really came to connect with the Wisconsin Public Education Network and others who care deeply about making sure that our public dollars follow our public values, and we make sure that we are setting our kids up to succeed and not to fail in our schools.
Mm-hmm. In your new role, and you took over as executive director in 2017, what was it, and I know you had done work with the Wisconsin Public Education Network before you became executive director. You served as a coordinator. You were doing some work with the organization. But what is it, and what was it about the Wisconsin Public Education Network that really got you excited to actually apply for the position? What was the impetus?
Well, our network is truly a grassroots local action hub. We are a group of people who come from various backgrounds and areas of interest and expertise. Our partners around the state range from parents like me to professors at the university, to educators, to school board members and superintendents, and community members, business leaders, people who are just concerned about the future of our schools. And prior to 2016, when I was hired as their coordinator, this network was kind of just a loose coalition. Didn't have a name, was just a group of people who cared a lot, who were meeting regularly to talk about what kind of policy was on the agenda, what could we do about it, and most importantly, how could we form a stronger collective voice so that we aren't always in competition for resources or feeling like we're isolated in our struggles, whether it's based on what your job is or what community you live in or what specific concerns are on your own horizon at the moment. And so when the network decided to start fundraising and become, you know, kind of an official organization with hired staff and so on, I just sensed immediately that this was the sort of work that I was really committed to doing, that I had a passion and a talent for, and that was most importantly, critically imperative at that time, particularly in this post-Act 10 world where teacher voice has been minimized, where communities feel frustrated and voters feel disenfranchised and kind of silenced out of the conversation about politics. And I thought, that's got to change. We can do better at democracy, and we can do better at helping our kids.
Sure. As you look at where we are right now, do you think we will see some major recovering, and I don't mean hoping we will, but obviously with a Republican state assembly and state senate, what are some of the items on your agenda with regards to the Wisconsin Public Education Network that you see at the top of the list that you want to, you know, really make sure are emphasized, say, the next 2 years for public education here in Wisconsin?
Well, first I'll say that we are indeed very optimistic about the chances of seeing some really transformative proposals put forward to help our kids. And that optimism is matched by an equal amount of determination to make sure that that happens. And so what we heard in this last election cycle, not just from the governor, but from almost every candidate in the race, is that people are just sick and tired of politics as usual. They're sick of people playing political games with kids in schools and issues that impact our daily lives. And they want to see our elected officials working together for policy that works for us. And so we hope to, you know, carry the momentum and the force of that sentiment into the next budget cycle discussion. And we do have some very specific policy items that we are focused on seeing some real transformative action on this year. And those were really the hallmark of our Vote Public campaign last year in urging folks to find out where their elected officials and candidates for public office stood on issues like school funding fairness. Mm-hmm. What are we going to do about the fact that some districts get more money per pupil than others and are allowed to spend more money than others on the kids in their district based on arbitrary decisions made over 20 years ago? What are we going to do about restoring the funding that has been cut from our public schools over the last decade? And how are we going to make sure that every school really does have what it needs to meet the most basic needs of every kid? Specifically here, what are we going to do about special education funding, mm-hmm. which has been flat frozen for over 10 years, even as costs continue to rise, even as needs continue to rise, and has been exposed as really the great crisis of the moment in terms of public ed funding? What kind of change are we going to see there? And is this going to be the year that we finally see some bipartisan consensus for a solution that works for schools?
Mm-hmm.
A couple of other areas we really want to see some transformative change are around restoring respect for our educators and making sure that the state is really taking an active role in ensuring that we can attract, hire, and retain educators who are the best people for our kids, the highest qualified, the best trained, keep our teacher certifications high and roll back some of the shortcuts that we've seen in recent years through the legislature. And I think most importantly, probably for many people, is restoring that great climate that we once enjoyed as a state, where people were so proud to live here, to teach here, to work here, to learn here, and kind of getting that spirit back to mm-hmm. Wisconsin, something that that has been missing for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, something you already touched on is we need to demand full accountability and full transparencies for all schools that are receiving public dollars to educate kids. Republicans and Democrats want to make this a partisan fight, right? One, you're either on one side or the other, for school choice or against. This isn't about choice. It's about doing what's right for kids. That means protecting them, protecting their interests, and protecting taxpayers by making sure that we know where our dollars are going, we know how they're being spent, and we know that kids are not being put at risk when they're in situations that are outside of the control of our systems, but yet totally funded by our tax dollars.
Mm-hmm. If you're just tuning in to this edition of Education Matters, I'm Steve Brown, your host this week, and my guest is Heather Dubois-Bornain, who is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Public Education Network. You know, when you talk about that, I'm just looking at an article, and the headline is Governor Tony Evers' Bipartisan Task Force Calling for Funding Hike, and it talks about promise that he made during the campaign to increase funding for public education by $1.4 billion, and also the establishment of a bipartisan task force, a bipartisan legislative task force, and that the co-chair of that commission is Senator Luther Olson from Ripon, and Luther's been a guest on my program before, and he says, quote, "I don't think any of this stuff is going to be easy," and he would like to say that the hard work is done, but the hard work is just beginning, and now the rubber meets the road. But he also wants to see both sides working together. How optimistic are you? You know, if you could look into your crystal ball, WPEN crystal ball, what do you see happening over the next, say, 18 months to 2 years as far as the funding?
You know, Steve, that commission, that bipartisan commission, it was called the Blue Ribbon mm-hmm. Commission on School Funding, met all year last year. Their first meeting was last January in Milwaukee, and they held hearings all over the state. We went to every single one of them and took notes and recorded all of the testimony that we heard to look for patterns and to make sure that the solutions that commission put forward matched the concerns that were heard around the state. And so we were really impressed with the recommendations that came forward from that commission and the degree of overlap between those recommendations and the education budget that's already on the table that was proposed by Governor Evers when he was still superintendent of public instruction.
Mm-hmm.
And so that common ground that's already on the table gives me a lot of hope. I mean, it's crystal clear where the priority needs are and where we should be prioritizing putting our dollars. The question is, to what extent will this become another political football in a crazy budget year? You know, there's been talk of a budget showdown and working off a base budget and, you know, rejecting certain measures or proposals that have been put forward by Governor Evers. But I think that Senator Olson and his co-chair, Representative Joel Kitchens, really took their charge seriously on that commission and have worked hard to come up with some proposals that received unanimous support from all of the panelists. And I think that that will carry some weight with legislators on both sides. And whether we see those items in the budget or as standalone legislation, I think we can expect to see some real traction on many of those issues. And I think that that will be positive for our public schools.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that address the full scope of the funding problems facing our schools? Probably not, right? This was an opportunity to kind of revamp and revisit our school funding structure, and I'm not sure the recommendations go quite far enough in making sure that we're going to create long-term solutions to these problems, but it's a bigger and better start than we've seen in recent years at all, and you've got to applaud them for getting us to this point in a very civil and cordial way through that commission. Our call will simply be, okay, we have some grown-up ideas on the table, things that everybody agrees on. Let's, like, leave the politics aside and get some stuff done right now, and then we can go back to fighting about the other things.
Mm-hmm. One of the initiatives of the Wisconsin Public Education Network this past year was Vote Public 2018. Very briefly, what was that all about? And as you look back at that initiative, how successful was it?
You know, our Vote Public campaign was really simple. It was about making sure that our votes matched our values when it comes to public schools, that we want to vote for candidates who put our kids first and who, once elected, will be held accountable to us for putting them first. It's hard to do the sort of nonpartisan public education advocacy that we do in hyperpartisan times. And it's hard sometimes when, you know, everyone seems to be playing politics with the issue of school funding to come up with campaign that doesn't feed into that. But I think we very successfully kept our issue at the focus of every forum we attended, every community around the state, with a very simple message, which was, I love my public schools and I vote.
Mm-hmm.
We had yard signs and t-shirts and stickers and buttons that put forward this message. And we let Republicans and Democrats alike know that we were looking for candidates who would do the right thing when it came to putting kids first, and who would stand beside us when it was time to make sure that their needs were met.
Mm. It's sort of wrapping things up. I know that you're also on the advisory council, the What's Best for Kids Advisory Council that Governor Evers and Lieutenant Governor Barnes announced and appointed members. So you will certainly continue to be very active statewide in addition to what you're doing with WPEN.
Yeah, and we look forward to any opportunity that we have to make the everyday needs of our kids in schools part of that statewide conversation. I'm really appreciative of the choices that Governor Evers has made in appointing me to that council, but also appointing others who really kind of represent a sort of very local level grassroots voice of people who ultimately just want to see transformative change at the community level so that all kids can succeed and all communities can thrive.
Mm-hmm.
That's really at the heart of why we do the work that we do. And I feel hopeful that that's a message that can kind of transcend the partisanship that has often gotten in the way of our moving forward on initiatives that really make a difference.
Sure. And actually, my last question is there something that I should have asked you that I didn't?
Well, I would, if you don't mind, like to say a little bit about the advocacy we're doing around the state budget this year.
Sure, please.
Because last year our campaign was Vote Public, and now that we've voted and we've elected our officials to make some important decisions for us at the state level, it's time to hold them accountable for doing so. And the first and biggest opportunity we have to do that is through the passage of the next state budget.
Mm-hmm.
So we're working together with partners from the ACLU of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Leadership Development Project to hold some workshops around the state to prepare people to give testimony at public hearings on the budget, to educate their communities about why the budget matters and why it specifically matters to them, and to make a difference. Not just by speaking truth to power and connecting with their elected officials, but by connecting at the local level and really making their values clear to others in their community. We're going to be doing a series of four workshops in Eau Claire on March 9, in Middleton on March 3, in Kaukauna on March 2, and in Milwaukee on March 10. And you can go to our website at wisconsinnetwork.org and click on the budget HQ tab to mm-hmm. find out more about how you can get registered for those events. We hope to use this budget cycle as a way of engaging more people around the issue of public education and around issues more generally of what does it mean to raise our voices in a democracy to guarantee thriving communities. We can do this together, and we invite everyone to join us.
Okay, very good. I want to thank you for, Heather, I want to thank you for being my guest this morning on Education Matters. Thank you for everything that you do in your role as Executive Director for the Wisconsin Public Education Network. And there's a lot of work ahead. And I think the phrase, what's best for kids should always be and must always be first and foremost in all of our minds, and thank you so much for all the work that you do and your organization.
Thanks, and thank you, Steve, for the service you provide in highlighting education issues on your program.
And we continue Education Matters today, and I'm your host, Steve Brown, and in this segment, I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. David Bob, who is president of the Bill of Rights Institute, and they're located in Arlington, Virginia. They are a nationwide institute that does all kinds of exciting stuff, and we're going to be talking about all the things that the Bill of Rights Institute does. Dr. Bob, welcome to Education Matters.
Wonderful to be with you.
Before we get into a discussion of what the institute does, perhaps you can give us a bit of your own background, where you got your education.
Yes, so I earned a PhD in political science from Boston College, was spurred to study politics and came to a love of history from a really amazing teacher that I had for high school. I went to a private school in Minnesota in the Twin Cities area and owe a lot to this gentleman, Brian Bonney, who was a teacher who really understood how to make these ideas that can seem very obscure come alive.
Hmm. What was it about Mr. Bonney? I mean, very specifically for you that really had that impact that made the difference.
I was one of those kids that when I gave an answer, I was a little too confident about it. And I was prone to offer, when it came to discussion of current events, sort of bumper sticker bromides. And very quickly, I think what I saw in and what I received from this feature was that kind of corrective that said, have you really thought that through? He had that Socratic mode of learning, life-changing for me, because not only did he challenge me, but he also then was able to, you know, because as a young person, you feel kind of like your bubble's been burst a little bit, right? You go in, you're brimming with confidence, you articulate these views, and you think, I'm just right on the money. And you realize pretty quickly there are so many different perspectives out there. There are so many different viewpoints. And you better slow down and think about what other people have to say. And things get pretty complicated quickly. And that can be an unnerving experience for young people. But I think one of the great things about this teacher was that he was there to help kind of reconstitute how do you then pull together your own viewpoint? How do you come to really have a coherent view of things, not just the political, but of course, when you're in high school, you're trying to figure out who are you as a person.
Sure, and don't you also think that in today's world, with when you look at our political landscape today in 2019, I don't want to overstate it, but I will. And that is, things are so polarized, you know, the left and the right, the Democrats, the Republicans, those who like a candidate or an office holder and those who don't. This whole thing of looking at the facts and trying to answer a question or analyze it internally without getting so political and looking at it from that point of view, as you were just talking about, that Mr. Bonney did. Or if you watch the paper chase, the sort of thing that wonderful Professor Kingsfield would use, that Socratic method to make us think about your answer and why, and not just the answer, but how you came up with that answer.
I agree completely. I think that it's one of my preoccupations now as a political scientist, as someone who's been in the civic education arena nearly 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that this polarization is very caustic. Young people are not feeling it in the same way that adults do, they feel it nonetheless. And they know that there's there can be a chilling effect to this,
mm-hmm.
which is to teenagers, sit down and shut up. You don't have much to say.
Sure.
Or to use them too quickly as cudgels in the polarized debate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's what we have to do in the classroom is ask those why questions.
Sure.
And you know, there's been a spate of articles recently, including in Education Week. Students are demanding more and more to know, why does history, the study of history, matter? Why does civic education matter? And I think that's a really great question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad
mm-hmm.
when students ask that. I think they deserve a good answer on that.
Sure, I would agree. And on your website, on the Bill of Rights Institute website, and I promise we are going to talk about the Institute, but on your website, billofrightsinstitute.org, where it has information about your background, it very specifically says that you have worked for 20 years at the intersection of civic engagement and educational reform, and the first time I read that, I was, you know, immediately in my mind, having been a high school teacher, I was thinking about Emma Gonzalez and David Hogue, who were there down in Florida at Parkland, you know, in Parkland, Florida, you know, when they had the terrible shootings back on February 14th of 2018, and how vocal they and other students have become. And they're talking about something that was very serious, and we still talk about it. And how do we say to young people, because your organization does so many great things for educators, you know, for teachers, but just so many incredible things for students. How do we say it's okay to talk about something that is political as long as you have the facts, as long as you know what you're talking about and you can defend it?
It's a great question, and I think of it in terms of even a kind of term that we've kicked around on the Bill of Rights Institute team, which is think the vote. You know, before you can rock the vote, you have to know what you're talking about. And that's not to say that you have to be an expert, because I am interested in seeing young people exercise their right to vote. But I think there's a point where you can push them too quickly into that stage, the action stage, when there hasn't been time to reflect. And the adolescent period is a great time to think about what is it that I really believe?
Mm-hmm.
And what we've seen is in informal debates online for tens of thousands of high school students, formal debate work that we do with the National Speech and Debate Association, the largest group for high school debaters in the country, and then also just in convening students across the country, they are very hungry, those who are interested in current events, those who are interested in what's happening in their high schools and coming up with action plans. They feel very often that there's not enough debate happening in politics in general and in their schools. And so when they come together, for example, in a week-long program in Washington, D.C. that we sponsor called Constitutional Academy, they feel kind of liberated to be able to be with peers who are not apathetic, who are plugged in, who have a voice. And we want to continue to spur that all across this country, because there's so many students that feel like they do not have a voice. They don't have a platform, I guess you'd say. And it's important that they know what they're talking about as much as is possible for a young person, and then that they can dive right in to things that are going to change the system in ways that will be of mutual benefit to everyone.
Mm-hmm. As I examined and studied the website, the Bill of Rights Institute website, there's such an incredible amount of wonderful material. And in the time that we have, maybe if you could touch upon maybe three or four of the major projects that the Institute is engaged in, and in particular focusing in, as you've already alluded to, those programs and projects that are really important for young people.
Certainly. The basic work of the Bill of Rights Institute is to go straight to teachers with the resources, the curricular resources that honor the work that they do, and make it as easy as possible for educators to bridge the kind of gap that often has between the things that they need to accomplish in the lesson that day and the discussion of current events. So one of our most popular resources is an e-lesson that we mail out to tens of thousands of teachers. And this might be something related to breaking news that would give the teachers a way to convey the underlying principles of the American founding. If you think of civics as very simply knowing, loving, and defending the principles of the Declaration and Constitution, the important thing I think for us to know today about civics is that it's taking those principles that are in the Declaration, equality, justice, liberty for all, and applying them to today's problems. And so with all of the social studies teachers, I find that the main thing that they're concerned about is how do we spur these conversations? How do we get students thinking? And, you know, most 16-year-olds don't wake up saying, boy, today I really want to dig into the separation of powers, right? It's not the kind of thing, you hear all these laments out there, only certain number percentage of Americans know that there's three branches of government. Well, it'd be great if everybody knew that there are three branches of government, but that wouldn't fundamentally change our country. What would is an application and knowing the why of that. Why do we separate powers? Why is it that we have upheld freedom, but why is it that we have avoided the tyranny that comes when all of the powers are lodged in one person or in one power center? That's a question that young people can care about. And there are many things that are happening even today that pique their interest. And so what we try to do is through the publication of free and open resources, make that available, make those vehicles for discussion available to teachers across the country.
With the institutes that you run, and the essay contest, why do you think those institutes and activities and the seminars and the workshops are so popular today that students are really reaching out for, you know, wanting to have more in-depth conversations that maybe they just can't have on a day-to-day basis in their lives, whether it's at school or at home?
Yes, I think there's a good deal of that that's true, and I think it's true not only for young people but for teachers. And, mm-hmm. and we sense a strong desire for others, parents, grandparents who are trying to have these conversations. Even you look to what's happening in our places of work, where it's more and more difficult, or in neighborhood gatherings to talk about things that yes might be political, but that doesn't mean that they have to be divisive.
Right.
And I think the thing that we do, you know, if the first thing you think of that we do is free and open resources for teachers and students, the second thing is, are these kind of inspiring educational experiences. Imagine that you're a teacher and you want to teach the topic of immigration, and you're looking at Ellis Island. The headlines today are all rife with controversy about this issue.
Mm-hmm.
So we publish a curriculum, and then we have a conversation with teachers in professional development programs held across the country. We found this topic, the question of religious liberty and controversy surrounding that, what you might think of as kind of troublesome or difficult issues. If you're a teacher and you want to teach about immigration, and in your class you have dreamers,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and you might have families that believe that we should have a wall built, your tendency might be to say, you know what, I'm not going to touch that. That's a third rail.
Sure.
Our mission is to equip teachers so that they can touch the third rail without getting electrocuted, and that they can do so in a way that really ennobles the conversation. And when you do that, you find that students raise their hand and say, I want to participate in this too. I want to be part of the solution. I want to try to figure this out. And next thing you know, you have a really great conversation that's involving a lot of young learners, and the educators who are doing such an amazing job of trying to navigate all of this. They can find communities even outside of their own school buildings for support. And so that's the kind of thing that we're doing across the country, have done so with more than 25,000 educators having participated in these professional development programs in the 20 years that BRI has been around.
Mm-hmm. How do you handle? I mean, at all the institutes that you do, and I was just looking at the one of the sites on the Bill of Rights Institute.org site, free speech or safe speech, and there are a number of topics here. Why a free speech fight is causing protests at Yale University. The new intolerance of student activism when free speech becomes a political weapon. When all these seminars and institutes are held, or the webinars, whatever they might be, this whole idea of talking about something that is so politically charged, How is that dealt with? You sort of touched upon it already as far as that third rail, and it's far easier, isn't it, just to avoid that third rail versus, you know, I'm going to touch that third rail, but I'm going to have my other hand on something where I can balance it with other things so we can actually talk about these really critical issues.
I think there are a couple of tools that find most valuable, and that is primary source documents. So go to the source. That shifts the debate. You know, I don't believe it's the job of a teacher to have to put his or her political views out there. For one thing, when you do that, it changes the tenor of the conversation. Students naturally gravitate, try to curry favor with the view that you, the teacher, might have, as opposed to thinking for themselves. So I think there's a way in which when you do that and you wrap around it a kind of Socratic method or mode, of inquiry where you're trying to get to the why of that. What's at the heart of our conflict over immigration today? What are the historic antecedents? And then that pushes you back to abstract principles. And that's when you can start to see some progress in saying, what does it mean to have equality under law? What does it mean to be a nation that has historically welcomed those who wish to be good Americans?
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing that you want to push back to. And that's where I think the touchstone of our work, being in those constitutional principles, those founding ideas, if you lead with those, it can make it very difficult because people are saying, well, this is my notion of equality. And the person will counter with, well, this is my understanding of it. And very quickly, you have people at loggerheads. But if you use some timely but also timeless pedagogical principles, and you combine that with excellent content, we find that the teachers feel more emboldened to be able to take up these topics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will say there's a critical, and I think this is one of the areas that we really have to work on as a country, and that is parents need to support teachers who are doing this work.
Sure.
And not say to them, well, I don't want my child to hear anything that differs from what we talk about at home.
Mm-hmm.
If we continue to have that mentality, it will only continue to make us more polarized. And unfortunately, we see a fair bit of that out there.
Sure, sure. My next to last question My next to last question deals with how you fund everything that you do. But my last question is going to be, I'm going to ask you to think about and actually give me a 20 or 30 second promo about the Bill of Rights Institute. So if we aired that, it would get people excited to go to the website, get involved. But the question before that, David, is with all the great things that you do, how do you fund everything that you do? Who are some of your major sponsors? How can people get involved if they want to make a contribution and do things of that nature?
We are funded by a wide array of foundations and individuals. So over the course of BRI's 20 years of existence, 2019 marks our 20-year anniversary, we've been funded by more than 13,000 individuals and foundations. I would welcome anyone who wants to help us out to go to the Empower section on the Bill of Rights Institute website, which is billofrightsinstitute.org. We partner with wonderful philanthropists who care deeply about the future of this country, and what your investment is really in is in the future leadership, those young people who will grow to become the next generation of leaders.
Mm. Okay, excellent. And finally, if you were standing in front of 500 people and someone said, Dr. Bob, you have 20 or 30 seconds, and we want you to give us your best thoughts about why the Bill of Rights Institute is so wonderful and why students and teachers and educators and parents and community members should get involved with it, what would you say?
The great abolitionist and orator Frederick Douglass said, a single individual armed with truth is a majority against the world. The Bill of Rights Institute is in the business of making those kind of individuals who care most about truth and who are willing to devote their lives to the pursuit of that truth. We work with teachers who have this amazing ability to reach so many students. The average teacher reaches 100 kids. And in turn, we're trying to support those teachers to create a network of young people across this country who can be like Douglass in really living up to the promise of the Declaration of Independence.
I think that is as strong a statement as I could ever think of. I think if our listeners also go to the Bill of Rights Institute.org. And read the statement of academic integrity. I think adding that to what you just said, David, I think it's extraordinary. Dr. David Bob, I want to thank you so much for being our guest this morning on Education Matters. But most importantly, thank you and thank the Bill of Rights Institute for the incredible work that you're doing.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity to talk.
I'm Steve Brown, your host this morning here on Education Matters. And my guests this morning were Heather Dubois-Bornain, who is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Public Education Network, and also Dr. David Bob, who is Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Institute, located in Arlington, Virginia. For Education Matters here on WGTD-HD, I'm Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening. You've been